Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and I'm joined today by two very special guests because we're again going off book and we're not covering the actual X-Files episodes. It's another interview, and I am really delighted today to be joined by Philip Malcolm and Lindsay Kearns. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
And just to give you a little bit of a background, these two people, as well as a lot of other really talented people involved, 4-5 years ago, staged what is known as the X-Files The Musical. And it is kind of a semi-legendary thing that's now on YouTube, all on YouTube. And it is an absolute joy of a fan-made show about the X-Files. And you two were key and instrumental to the whole thing, weren't you? You actually performed and, I imagine, helped create the whole thing, didn't you?
Lindsay and I and another friend named Aaron worked together to write it, and I acted in it, and Lindsay and Aaron helped produce it.
Awesome. You played Mulder, didn't you, I think?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but Phil played Mulder, and a lovely lady named Laura portrayed Scully, and that actually sparked a real life romance that led to them eventually getting married.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations. That's so nice to hear.
2 years down, two to go.
Oh, awesome. Oh, that's so nice. That's brilliant. Well, you know, in fairness, you could tell there was some chemistry there when watching. So, you know, and, you know, anyone might have thought that it was just Mulder and Scully, you know, just you were acting really well. But yeah, I can see it. So that's great. That's really nice. Okay, but before we get talking about the show and everything like that, I'm going to ask you, as I ask everyone on the X-Cast, what I call the 5 questions of X. So this is just to give a little insight into your fandom and what you think of the show and everything like that. So, and you can answer, either of you can answer first, but I'll ask you first, what got you into the X-Files?
Lindsay, you're up.
Okay, well, I think maybe Phil got me into the X-Files. Phil and Aaron and another friend of ours, Joanna, who helped produce the show, had always been huge X-Files fans, and I am a scaredy cat and was always afraid of watching the X-Files. So at some point, we all went to high school together, and at some point, I think I was dragged into someone's basement where they forced me against my will to watch some X-Files episodes, and I was terrified.
That sounds really, really disturbing, really dark moment in your life.
It was like its own X-Files episode. And I can tell you that the first episode I watched was Squeeze, which I think is one of the most terrifying episodes. And I've never looked at air vents the same way after that. And when Phil and Aaron had the idea to do X-Files the Musical, it was on the heels of a couple other pop culture parody musicals that we had done. We did Jurassic Park the Musical and Dr. Quinn the Musical. And I was excited about the possibilities, but I was the one who had to do the most homework going into it and force myself to watch more X-Files episodes and face my fears going in.
You did it well, in fairness. Phil, how about you?
I got introduced to the X-Files, I don't even remember when. I have some vague memories of being like 8 years old and it being Sunday night and being at my parents' house watching a show that creeped the crap out of me. And at that, you know, I kind of watched it here and there throughout childhood. And then in high school, a group of us really, really started watching it. I think Joanna had a whole bunch of episodes copied onto VHS tapes because that was how you recorded things at the time.
I remember. And
so, I think that she had some like endless supply of 90-minute VHS tapes full of episodes. And so we would go to her house and sort through this massive library and watch them. That was when I really became a big fan, I would say, early in high school. But I've kind of liked spooky shows or things that are about the paranormal, you know, since childhood. So
cool, yeah. I also remember taping them on VHS. Yeah, it was the same thing here. Yeah. Oh, dear. Child of the 90s, that's what it was. So, Okay, question two. Thank you for that. Question two is, what is your favorite episode of The X-Files? Lindsay.
My favorite episodes are the ones that are not so scary, usually. I love X-Cops as just like a parody. Yeah. That's definitely in my wheelhouse. I love it whenever The X-Files is making fun of something or just kind of going down the comedy route. So I would have to say that's my favorite episode. I don't know if that's a popular choice.
Well, it should be, because I think it's massively underrated, the X-Cops. Yeah, it's so funny, and yeah.
I think it's like, it was pretty innovative, I think, for a drama, like a sci-fi drama, to do something that was like such an obvious parody in the 90s. So I like it for that reason as well.
Good choice. Good choice. Phil?
I've got like a favorite serious one and a favorite funny one.
It's fine.
My favorite serious one is Paper Hearts. I think a season 4 episode. It's the one where Mulder's trying to track down the victims of a serial killer. And he thinks that it's possible that his sister might be one of them. And there's kind of this back and forth with the serial killer who's in prison at the time. And Mulder's sister stuff is probably the most compelling thing in the show. And so any episodes that are about that and Mulder's kind of hopeless search to find her, I really like. But then for a funny episode, I really love Arcadia.
Yes.
I think it's season 6. Just really, really playing on the sexual tension with Mulder and Scully. And they get like, they don't really play up the fact that they're annoyed with each other until probably seasons 5 or 6. But that's a great one. Mm-hmm. Just their kind of back and forth. So,
mate, having them be married, it's comedy gold, yeah. Isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Although I don't think I can think of Samantha quite the same way, having watched the musical now. I just think of her as a goose. It's brilliant. Okay,
that
so
very happy. We ruined it for you.
Yes, you did. Thank you. Question three, then, off the back of that, what is your favorite season of The X-Files?
You know, I am such my X-Files knowledge and viewing is always so spotty that I've never watched them in consecutive order, nor do I have like a really good idea of what happens when. Possibly also because my knowledge of the X-Files mythology is now like all mixed up with this crazy stuff that we invented for the musical. So I'm for sure the worst person to answer this question. So I'm gonna say this one's on you, Phil.
Lindsay, we need to make a chart of season, and your favorite one will be whichever one has the least scary episodes.
Yeah, that is true. I'm like, what's the least scary season? That's my favorite.
I think probably season 7 then, because you said X-Cops, and it's just most of the season is parody. So yeah.
Season 7 is my favorite. Officially.
It's because you love that terrible video game episode that's in season 7. What's that one called? Person Shooter?
Yeah.
You haven't really seen it, Lindsay.
I probably haven't seen it.
Beyond your X-Files knowledge, but...
I think all I ever hear is that one's terrible, and I really like that. But then it's got the Lone Gunman in, and there is no episode of the X-Files that I don't like with the Lone Gunman. Do you know what I mean? So it's that
right.
Kind of thing.
Just kidding. It's great. I love it.
Phil, how about you then?
My favorite season is probably 4.
Mm.
It's just, I think the mythology is the most compelling on that one, and they have the most interesting stories. 6 is pretty good too, though. 6 doesn't really have many duds, which is great. You know, it's tough to pull that off with a season that has over 20 episodes, but that one's pretty consistent all the way through. So one of the two of those, probably 4, I guess, at the end of the day.
I've often said 4 myself, actually. Either 2, 3, or 4, but 4's got some tremendous episodes. But yeah, good choices, good choices. And you covered your lack of knowledge well there, Lindsay, to be fair. You got away with that. Okay, then, question 4. Who is your favourite character on the show? Now, this doesn't have to just be Mulder or Scully. It can be anybody, even if it's like a guest character.
My favourite character is Skinner. only because he has one emotion, and it's, stressed out anger.
Frustration.
Yeah, even when he's on their side, he's always, like, my ass is on the line, and I don't know how it's on the line, but it always is.
You guys sent that up so well, though, in the musical. Skinner was, I mean, it was all great, but Skinner was by far the funniest character in that entire show, because he was, you just took it to the nth degree with him, you know, just having, my ass is on the line all the time. Yeah. It's great.
That performance by Topher was just truly brilliant, and he consistently through all of the rehearsals would crack us up, and he just brought so much to the role that I think a lot of that was in the script, but a lot of it was truly just what he brought to the role. And he was very brave in many regards. He was willing to get like mostly naked on stage in front of a crowd of families. So bravo to him.
He got stuck underground for a long period. This is my favorite story about the show.
Yeah. Well, really? He actually did? I thought that was a metaphor.
Yeah, so the first night of the show actually got rained out.
Yes, I'm going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Like 1,000 people or something sitting outside watching the show. And part of our set was in the middle of the audience. We had dug this massive hole and covered it with trapdoors for some surprise to come out of it later. And Topher was down there at the time. And so the show gets rained. The show's about to get rained out. The storm's coming in. We tell everyone they need to leave. So people are just like standing up in this area and milling around and taking their time getting out of there because it hasn't actually started raining really hard yet. And we found out later that he was stuck down there for like an hour or more.
God.
Just in this like terrible, like psychopath's hole.
And Topher had a flashlight down there. We had given that to him because like when the show was going at properly, he was still going to have to spend 15 or 20 minutes in that hole. Like that was our whole plan. But so we had a flashlight down there, and we also had there was another character that came out of that hole, and that character had a prop, and the prop was the book, The Da Vinci Code. So according to lore, Topher was just down there for an hour with that flashlight reading the Da Vinci Code.
I don't know what's worse, being trapped underground in a hellhole or having to read that book.
Exactly. He was so committed to the surprise, though, of him coming out of the ground. I know this is a diversion from the question, but I have to mention that we were so excited about this hole. We had like 12 people digging it the day before the first show, and we were like, when Topher comes out of this hole, everyone is going to gasp. It's going to be the biggest surprise. It's going to be a showstopper. And the truth is that like when Topher came out of the hole, no one looked surprised. It was like everyone clearly knew there was a man in that hole.
Yeah. And I've been reading the Da Vinci Code the whole time.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Doing the voices.
Lindsay, then, what about you? Who would you say your favorite character is?
Well, one of my favorite guest actors was portrayed by Luke Wilson in the episode Bad Blood, which is also, I'm sure, a popular episode and one of my favorite episodes. But
Gillian Anderson's favorite episode, actually, Bad Blood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the one she loves the most.
Oh, well, we do have a lot in common, now that I mention it. Yeah, so I think that's just a really fun, memorable character. And even though this is cliche, I do have to say Mulder is probably my... I mean, obviously, it's very interesting that he's portrayed by David Duchovny, and, you know, I like that about him. But I also just think that his quest and his search for truth is sort of, I mean, it's clearly like the engine that moves the show along. So it's, if you don't buy into Mulder, then you really don't buy into the X-Files. So I think for me, he is the heart of the show. And I think for most people, he is as well.
Yeah. It was never that, even though the, you know, the last two seasons aren't necessarily always as bad as people think, it wasn't the same when Mulder wasn't there, was it really? So no,
right.
I understand that. Yeah. Okay, well, my final question then here is, do you have a particularly favourite moment from the show or something, a scene or anything from The X-Files that you just remember and you love?
Mine is probably not very sincere, but there's a moment in season 9, and this is like kind of when the show has started to to really creep toward the end. And there's a mythology episode. I don't even remember which one it is. But, like, Monica's just starting to get caught up on the mythology in the episode. And she's just finding out about the end of season 6, I think it is. Or maybe it's 5, where Scully discovers that spaceship. I think it's the end of 5 into 6. And she discovers that spaceship that has writings on it from, like, every major religion. And Monica asks her... she says something like, yeah, but all it had was what was on it anyway. And it gets, like, deathly serious. And Gillian Anderson, to her credit, musters a lot of strength to bring gravity to the line, words, powerful words.
I remember. I think that's either Provenance or Providence, mid-season 9, because that's where they go back to the spaceship from Biogenesis. So,
There's just, like, this pause before she says it. Everything gets quiet for a second. And you expect, like, just this big delivery, and she's like, they were words. Powerful words.
I'm not gonna...
and no one is like, what? Yeah. Everyone is like, that makes sense. That's a problem.
I'm not going to be able to look at that again in the same. I love the way you're both making me seed at the show in a different way. It's great. Lindsay, go on then. What about you?
This is not very specific, but I love whenever Scully is performing an autopsy because of the pseudoscience that is whatever is going on that table has nothing to do with science. It's just like pulling out organs and weighing them and throwing them around. Like I think it is a tribute to what a great actress Gillian Anderson is that she always makes whatever science she's doing seem real. But it is funny if you start to just kind of like calculate how much time she spends doing these horrible, gross autopsies. And I think that's fun. And that's also why I think for better or worse, we devoted an entire song in X-Files the Musical to autopsies.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it did a lot to move the plot along in the musical. It may have been a misstep, but we just really liked the idea of her talking about her heart while she was holding a literal heart and going through those motions.
I think one of the best moments in the show, the X-Files, is when I think it's Bad Blood actually again, where she's doing an autopsy, and it's from, I think it's the side of it where it's Mulder's. So when it's his perspective, and she's weighing, or it might be Scully's perspective, she's weighing like the liver and the heart and everything, and she's doing it with such, I don't know if you remember this scene, but she's doing it so fed up. She's like, liver is like 4 pounds, just puts it on, and then all the intestines fall off, and it's just her look as if to say, oh God, this is my life. I think that sums it up really.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
I love how Mulder always makes her do autopsies. Like, it's always like, Scully, you need to do an autopsy. And she's like, okay, well, we better schedule it. And he's like, no, right now. It's 2 a.m. And this case is going to completely fall together if we can just figure out how big that Cheeto was that he choked.
And then he'll do the whole classic Mulder walking off, and he's not going to tell her where he's going. He just goes off, and she goes, where are you going? He's just to see someone, you know, and then she's left having to get the hands in guts, and he's off. No, I know. Poor Scully. It was a shame. Okay, that's the 5 questions of X. Great answers, guys. You've really hit on things a lot of other people haven't there, which is awesome. So this is the part now which you've all been looking forward to, which is where we talk about X-Files the Musical. So I'd like you all now to go to YouTube and type in X-Files the Musical and go and watch it. And that's my best piece of advice. Before you listen to us carry on talking, because we're going to get into the show. So yeah, go and watch it. It's a great experience. And let's listen to a little bit of a clip.
You guys are seriously telling me that the
2
of you are not friends with Benefits.
Of course we're friends with Benefits.
Oh, yeah.
And the benefits are trust and loyalty. You know what? No, Scully and I are FBI partners. We couldn't date even if we utterly, passionately, really deeply, forever wanted to. Which we don't.
I mean, what are you basing this off of anyways, Chad? I mean, yeah, we spend all of our time together, and we can finish each other's thoughts, and we, you know...
We share gum,
but, you know, that's what good FBI partners do, and that will never change.
No, we wouldn't want to ruin our perfect partnership. That's why we'll always be totally...
Platonically.
Us.
We've been together, seems like forever.
Forever with you sounds okay to me.
And we're always fighting, wronging and righting.
And dating and nighting so happily.
But whatever happens to you,
whatever happens to me. Even if you have an alien baby, totally platonically.
So you've touched a little bit on this, Lindsay, earlier, but what was the genesis of the idea? Because I know you'd done musicals before The X-Files, and you were, as part of the theatre group that you're in, the Colonel Mustard House group. What was the inspiration for doing X-Files, the musical, then?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Perhaps Phil remembers more clearly, but I do know that Phil and Aaron and our producer, Joanna, just had this deep, deep love for The X-Files, and I was aware of that, but they, I think we finished doing Dr. Quinn the musical, which was truly like my dream show to parody. And so I think it was their turn to parody their favorite show. And so that's my memory of it. But Phil, what do you think really sparked this one specifically?
Well, you know, at the beginning, when we were doing those first musicals, everything was... It wasn't just like, we would never think like, well, what's the funniest thing that we could turn into a musical? It was always like, what's a thing that we are currently really interested in and think is funny? Or you know, and so Jurassic Park, Aaron and I were really big fans of, I mean, everyone's a big fan of Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And Dr. Quinn, we had people who, for whatever reason, were watching through that series at the time. I don't know why.
You know, I can tell you that Joanna somehow got the DVDs, and then one night we started watching it, and we realized it was the funniest thing ever. And, like, we loved it as much as we laughed at it. And so that began my lifelong passion for Dr. Quinn.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, and then X-Files is just something that, as a group of friends, we all also were interested in. So it was just a matter of, you know, those were the three most formative pop culture things for us at the time.
And to add to that, I would say that all three of those TV shows / movies, it was more than a story and it was more than characters. It was really like a world that we enjoyed exploring and a world that you could build out other stories in. And I think that's what made The X-Files so great for a musical, is that there's this whole mythology that is a foundation for you to jump off of. And so, yeah, I think that was part of the appeal.
Yeah.
I think as someone watching it, and, you know, as a huge fan of the show for 20-odd years, watching what you did with it was, you can tell that it was made with a lot of love. and a lot of understanding, actually, of the show, in that obviously it's all parody, and you take all the heightened comedic bits from the characters in the show and you really punch it up. But I think without a knowledge of what you were parodying and an understanding of the show and a love for it, I don't think it would have been done as well. And that's why I think, you know, I was laughing and I got all the jokes, I got all the in jokes, all the references. And it was lovely. It was just lovely to sit there and watch it, because you're thinking as a fan, it's just, you can just feel the love. And I think that's what you get from it.
Thank you. That's so great to hear.
I think that it makes a difference that like we talked about, these are things that we just already were interested in. I think if we had sat down and we were like, you know, we're going to write a Breaking Bad musical or something. But I do love Breaking Bad. It wouldn't have been the same thing, because the research is all like, you go and you find your 6 jokes that you need to put in that are referential. But when you're writing a show that you really, really enjoy the source material, a lot of those things just kind of happen. You don't necessarily have to think about which jokes or which references you want in there, because they're all kind of naturally part of your experience. You just, you know, you kind of know them. The best comparison I can give is that this year the show we did was, it was a parody of The Brothers Karamazov.
Oh, fantastic.
Massive Russian novel. And it was the same sort of experience. You know, you don't have to go through and like research what all of the important parts are, because if it's something that's just been part of your like cultural understanding, they're just there. And I think that, I think it helped writing the show, because like you mentioned, it helped us to make a show that was a parody, but a really, really loving parody, and not just, it would be funny to do a musical on this. So there was
definitely a difference. Well, I was curious while I was watching it and thinking about all the people in it. How did you all come together then? Because the Colonel Mustard house itself seems to have a fascinating history about a man called Albert Watkins, I believe, in it's Lincoln, isn't it? Lincoln, Nebraska, where you're based. Tell me a bit more about the Mustard House and how you came together as a group.
Yeah. Well, you know, like the X-Files, some of this is history and some of this is mythology. sort of Cliff's Notes version of the story is that I was living in the house, I suppose back in 2007, and we had 6 people living in this giant, rambling Victorian mansion that it was a historical home in Lincoln, Nebraska, near the university, downtown. And we were throwing a Christmas party, and we thought, oh, wouldn't it be so fun if we did a Christmas play in the middle of the Christmas party? And so I was a theater major and interested in playwriting and all those things. So I just wrote a fun little play. It was really only rehearsed once right before the party, and no one was off book. And it was truly kind of terrible, but also really magical. Because it was so spontaneous and it was very funny, sometimes accidentally and sometimes on purpose. And it ended with everyone singing Auld Lang Syne together, like 100 people, maybe 60 people in the attic of this mansion singing Auld Lang Syne together, like truly from the bottoms of our hearts, like really meaning it. And that was like such a crazy experience that then after that, we were like, oh, we got to do more. And Aaron approached me and was like, I want to do another play up here, and I want it to be science fiction. So Aaron and Phil wrote a brilliant parody of There Will Be Blood, and it was called There Might Be Blood. But it took place on Mars, and it was about oil drilling on Mars. And it was one of the funniest things ever. And unfortunately, we don't have video of it.
That's a shame.
But then, yeah. And after that, we do have plenty of embarrassing pictures from it. So that's the good news. But after that, we had always joked, oh, wouldn't it be so funny if we did a Jurassic Park the musical? I think that had become an inside joke for us. And I'd also like to note that this was before there were any other well-known Jurassic Park the musicals out there. and then Phil, because Phil is a musician and a composer, was like, well, we could actually do this. And I don't know if do you want to pick it up from there, Phil?
Sure. Yeah. So we, I think this was our senior year of college when we did Jurassic Park the musical, which was a terrible time to do it. basically what had happened was we told enough people that we were definitely going to do this that it was going to be really embarrassing if we didn't. And so we set to work trying to write this show. And so Aaron and I put a script together. And at the time, the joke was kind of like the joke at the very beginning of some of these musicals was that we didn't really know what we were doing. And so we put together like the smallest little ragtag orchestra that we could find. And we scored all of the parts wrong and just sort of like just went with it. And I think that we put that show on. I mean, we put some more time into the rehearsal for that, or at least into the prep. I think that we prepped for that show for like a week to a month. We rehearsed it for a day and then put it on. But, you know, it was just it was just about committing to something no matter how goofy and ridiculous it was, and then making sure that we actually pulled it off. And Lindsay produced it and pulled a lot of her friends in. And that show was kind of the first like jumping off point for us to grow and grab more people, because there were just so many friends that got excited about being involved in this in some capacity. And, you know, whether it was like, hey, I can make a giant paper mache egg, or, you know, like I have this weird collection of raptor masks in my basement, I'll bring them. through that we were able to start building this community up. And then from there, it just kind of took off. And we just gathered more and more volunteers and more people who were interested in doing creative stuff. And a lot of people who maybe didn't realize that they were creative, didn't otherwise have experiences that they could say, oh, yeah, I always did theater in college or whatever. You know, a lot of it was just like, you know, I work construction, so I've never been involved in theater, but I can build a set for you. I'd love to have some beers over the weekend. And so that's kind of... that kind of became our calling card. Was it was a great opportunity for just anyone to find a place in the arts, and we just ran with it. So,
yeah, and it truly was just a community. Like that, first and foremost, it was a community of friends who enjoyed hanging out together and being creative together. And then from that sprang like a very organic kind of theater company of sorts. And part of the history of Albert Watkins and all that is that we did some investigation into the history of the house itself, because we were sort of fascinated by that. And we found that it was built by this man who was like a philosopher and a historian and a teacher and a writer and like an all-around crank named Albert Watkins in the late 1800s, which I'm sure sounds very recent to someone from the UK, but in Nebraska, that's a very, very old house. And it's funny because like his obituary is like a lot of people saying like, well, he had a lot of strong opinions and he sure thought, you know, he sure thought a lot of things that made people maybe kind of mad, but he was very particular. Like people didn't have a lot of great things to say about him. Except it was clear that he had contributed a lot to writing about Nebraska history, and he was very politically involved and stuff like that. So we always thought he was a fascinating character, and he sort of became our patron saint of sorts, because we knew that he would hate everything that we were doing at the Colonel Mustard House. So we just did it for him in a way. And that kind of became part of the spirit of like, Albert Watkins was sort of a person who stood against shenanigans and creativity and friendship and all of these things. And yet, because of him, because of what he did, which was build this house, we're able to do all of this. So that is sort of the mythology of the Mustard.
It's possible that his purgatory or hell is to like wander that house as a ghost and see what we're doing with it right now.
The fun thing about the thing that's like truly like special about the experience of putting on a show at the Mustard is that there's this week or two before the show that we call Camp Mustard, where the entire house gets filled with people who are making things. So you walk through the house and it's full of garbage and it's out of control, and people are like putting together paper mache masks in one corner, painting giant signs in another corner. Someone brought a bounce house to the backyard just so people could have fun. And, you know, people are bringing in food donations and sleeping there because they're working on costumes and props late into the night. And it becomes like this just circus of crazy creativity that is also like why people come out of it with such fun friendships.
It sounds like a really cool place that brings community and a sense of community and friends together, that's just grown organically. That's brilliant. That's really great. And like you say, it's come out of this interesting irony about, you know, Albert not wanting anything like this. So
exactly.
Yeah, that's what makes it even greater. Just going back to the X-Files musical itself, you guys ran a Kickstarter back in 2011, didn't you, before the show, to actually get some funds to help with this. Now, this was when Kickstarter wasn't really as well known as it is now. So was that a successful campaign, and how did that come about?
Yeah, it was, so like you said, this was kind of like the very beginning of Kickstarter. And for X-Files, we knew that we're going to need more than the budget that we had used for previous shows. And by budget for previous shows, what I mean is that for Dr. Quinn, we asked everyone in the cast to bring $20, and that was the budget. And a lot of people, so that we knew that we would need, I don't know, like $1,000 or $1,500 or something. So we went to Kickstarter just to see if we could crowdfund it. It was kind of on a whim, I think. I don't think that we really expected that we were going to hit our goal. Because we just didn't have any sense of how it would work out. And I want to say our goal was like $1,500 and we got like $4,400 or something like that.
That's great.
We ended up getting picked to be, it was like, this was the very beginning when if you were a staff pick by Kickstarter, it meant that like one of the six employees of Kickstarter was combing through all the pages and legitimately really liked yours. And so it helped that we kind of got on their front page for a while. I think NPR did a story on Kickstarter at the time and used some clips from our stuff. We were just kind of right place, right time, I think, for that one.
Mm.
It was just right as it was starting to take off. So we had a really successful campaign. And some of it was just, you know, it helps when the joke of your show is the title. And people are able to just immediately know what that thing is and know whether it's funny. But
X-Files fans really came in droves to support that project. And it was really cool to be introduced to the wider X-Files fan community all around the world.
So did you get people from across the world donating? Did you get people from all over the world or all over the States anyway actually come to the show?
We did.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. We did, crazily. A lot of people that we didn't know, actually, maybe not a lot, maybe like 10 to 12 people that we didn't know just drove there to see it. And that was really cool. But we also did a live video stream, and I think that we had as many as 15,000 people check in on the live stream.
That's brilliant. That shows that it reached out there, and must have been really nice to see people who, like you say, you didn't know, fans who, you know, maybe donated or just had heard about it, just come down and watch.
Yeah, it was really cool. We actually even had somebody, I lived in the house for about a year after that show, and we had somebody show up from California because they were friends with a fan of the show from the UK, and they had told them that while they happened, like they were traveling cross country, and their friend had told them that while they were in Nebraska, they needed to go to Lincoln, find this house. So we just had these like two random strangers show up maybe 6 months later, just check the place out, and we didn't get murdered, which is awesome.
That's good. Always good. Yeah, that's brilliant though. That's that. Like I say, it, like I said earlier, it's like an element of legend about it. You know, go to the house where they did the X-Files musical. But obviously, it was outside. It was an outside production. And yeah. you had the misfortune, as you mentioned before, of having a thunderstorm rain off halfway through the first night. So it must have been quite challenging to stage it all outside, even in the summer.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about Nebraska is that it's in Tornado Alley, as they call it. So it's a very the weather is extremely unpredictable. And so every time we've done these outdoor musicals, we're basically like praying and doing like no rain dances just to hope that it holds off. And knock on wood, all of our performances except for this one performance of the X-Files have been rain free. But there's almost always like lightning on the horizon, and you just don't know if it's going to come your way. And so it was truly crazy because we had gone to so much work to put this show together. And thank goodness we were planning on performing it for two nights in a row. But when we had to cancel the show halfway through on night one, we all just kind of did. I mean, it was really depressing, honestly, because we were like, we put so much work into this and now it's ruined. But then because we had good weather the next day, I think we came in with so much joy and energy and excitement that we knew we'd be able to perform the show. And I think that made night two even more magical because we were like, this is our one shot and it's going to be the best we've ever done it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, our dress rehearsal had been rained out, too.
Oh, my God.
So, dress rehearsal, there had been a huge storm, and what we had to do is there was, like, a church office across the street from the place where we did the show, and we all crammed in there, like, all the cast and the orchestra, and the room was maybe, like, the size of three bedrooms. It was really small. That's where we did the dress rehearsal. So that second night that we did it was really probably the first time that we had top to bottom done the show without any stops.
Yeah.
There's a lot of adrenaline involved in that, but I believe what happened the first night is when it was so disappointing when it got rained out, because this is like the first time we'd actually built a big set. And, I think there were probably about 100 volunteers involved in some way with putting it on. And, I remember distinctly that right after we called off the show, Lindsay came up to me and with like the most seriousness I've ever seen on her face said, "We need to go buy a lot of beer right now." that was like priority number one in her life at that moment was we need to get as much beer as we can for everyone because they're going to need it.
That's the best way to react to an act of nature getting in the way.
That's producing at its finest right there.
my background as well is theatre back in the day, and watching it, considering that was your first go in terms really the first proper go, the amount of mistakes are almost non-existent. It really runs through really well considering, and that's a testament to how well and how much, like you say, Phil, how much adrenaline was there and everything, because you wouldn't know.
Well, that's so great to hear. I also want to point out that, like, a lot of the actors had never acted in anything before. Like, we kind of had this policy of casting people who were just naturally charismatic, but not necessarily actors or theater people. So we had a lot of people on stage who had done theater, whether in high school or college or whatever, but we also had a lot of people on stage who were just like, I got asked to do this, so I'm doing it.
We still often do cast everything like you would a Hollywood movie. So like it was like, well, we've got these 10 roles. Who'd be a great Scully?
Right.
And then like, instead of auditioning them, we'd just call them up and be like, "We're sure you're going to be good. Let's do it."
I've got faith in you. Yeah.
Yeah, we've never done auditions for anything. It's always just been, it's always been fated somehow that someone should play a character.
But again, it's all part of the organic kind of way that I think your group runs, really, and the sense of fun and the fact that you do it all with a sense of humor and a sense of, you know, tongue in cheek, but without still producing something, you know, really good and really enjoyable. And I think, you know, I was going to say next, the music in it was great. You know, the songs were really good and it was really well orchestrated and everything like that. So what did you write all of the songs, and in terms of actually how they were they were performed and everything. Who was involved in all that?
Yeah, so the lyrics were a combination of Aaron and Lindsay and I. The three of us all worked on them. I think for the most part, it would be just like one of us would write the lyrics to a song. I don't think we collaborated too much on them, maybe a little bit. But then I took those and I wrote the melodies. And I did most of the orchestrations. We had a friend named Nick Dahlquist, who was just living at the house with me at the time, who was a music student, and he did a little bit of work on them. And then Ben K. Skinner, who often conducts our orchestra, orchestrated a little bit of the music as well. So it was kind of, this is the thing that we really can only do at a certain time in your life when you have a lot of free time. But we put together, you know, all the music and the script for that, I want to say, and what do you think? At least the music we probably did in just like a few months, Lindsay. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the timeline was on that, but it was shorter than you think.
Yeah, and we didn't, just didn't sleep very much.
Yeah, and I don't know how, I don't even really recall the creative process exactly on that one. I think that we had so many conversations at the beginning about, like, what is this about? What are the characters? What's the story? Like, what are the jokes? That I think out of that, just the songs flowed really naturally because mm-hmm. we knew the kind of tone that we were going for. Some of the songs, I would say, if we could go back, we might lose a couple of the songs because the show is definitely too long. It's probably a lot easier to absorb on YouTube actually than in person when you're sitting on the ground watching it. But we had a lot of fun writing those songs, and they remain some of my favorite songs that we've ever written for any show.
You can see the fun in them. I think they're all really good, but I think my favorite is the Lone Gunman Barbershop Quartet.
Yeah,
I love that. Conspiracies.
Really good. Yeah, we actually had one other person, Alan Gilbert, I think, wrote that song. He's a friend of ours who's a computer programmer and also happens to sing Barbershop. And so we put that in, and that is not in my wheelhouse at all. So we went to Alan. We said, here are the words. You've got to make it happen because we don't know what we're doing. What he came up with was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Hearing that Barbershop Quartet for the first time, I think we heard it 2 days before the first performance. And it was such a jolt of energy to everyone because it sounded so good. Like, those four guys came in and just killed it, and I couldn't even believe it, because we were still trying to put everything else together, and we were, like, at a point where we were like, I don't know if this show's gonna happen, but then they knocked that out of the park. We were like, oh, yeah, we have a show, because we have this one really killer song for sure, so that was so exciting.
Yeah, they were all great. They were all really good, though. Some real showstoppers in there, and obviously, you know, a fun story weaving its way through, and lots of nods to, you know, the central romance and lots of characters popping up. So it was, you know, it was just fun all along the way. And I imagine that same sense of fun and parody is in a lot of your other work, because obviously, you know, like you said, there was the Dr. Quinn one and Jurassic Park. And I believe there was Spider-Man, the musical after this.
Right.
what other shows have come since the X-Files?
Well, after we did the X-Files, we wanted to challenge ourselves to do something that was not a parody, something that was just utterly original. And I will say, to our credit, with Dr. Quinn and with the X-Files, we were never parodying like a specific story. We were creating our own story and bringing a lot that was wholly original to it. But we were using these characters and this world that someone else had created. And we were also relying on a lot of referential humor. And so just to kind of like grow as writers, we were like, let's do something that's totally original. It's going to be about Nebraska. It's going to be about pioneers settling on the Great Plains. And also, to make it completely ridiculous, let's make it a choose-your-own-adventure musical that takes place over 10 square blocks downtown. And so I don't know how we ever thought that we could pull that off, but somehow we did, and that led to our next musical, which was called Gods of the Prairie. Which had its own sort of deep mythology. And Phil, do you want to talk a little bit about Gods of the Prairie?
Yeah. So Gods of the Prairie, I would say we probably borrowed a little bit because we took the structure of the ring cycle. We took that kind of basic story and then wrote it into like a totally different kind of hero's journey that we had in the prairie, but we did base it around some Norse mythology. As Lindsay mentioned, we did it as a choose your own adventure. So what we did is we set up, you know, maybe 6 or 7 kind of primary backbone scenes to the show. And the first one and the last one you really needed to see in order, but the other ones you could see in whatever order you wanted and they still made sense. And we basically split all, we had everyone watch the first part of the show. It was about 30 minutes long. And then we split the audience out all over downtown. And we had those scenes take place all over down there, and then they came back for the last one. The scenes went on a loop, so you knew that, you know, if you showed up at one of the scenes at 8:20, it would be going on then, but if you missed it, you could come back at, like, 8:40.
Yeah.
But then we also, the thing that really, you know, world building is something that we've really kind of latched onto and really enjoyed. And so... With that story, we just had so much material that we felt like we weren't able to fit into a normal 3-act show that we set up all of these tertiary scenes. They're sort of like, we kind of compared them to being side quests in a video game. And they were hidden all over throughout that neighborhood. There were probably a dozen of them. And as you were walking around, you could just stop and watch one of them. They'd be about 5 minutes and it'd be like a little bit of... a little bit of mythology that was kind of tangential to the story, but made you appreciate kind of what was going on a little bit more, maybe, or, you know, understand some in-jokes later or something like that. And then we built a map that we gave to everyone. We redrew the neighborhood as this, like, reimagined kind of prairie of the gods and encouraged people to go and explore all of these different locations and scenes that we kind of spread out throughout. That was a really fun show. It's probably the most experimental show we've ever done. But it was a really good time.
It sounds really innovative. You know, it sounds really interesting and clever.
Yeah, it was. I think for many people, it remains their favorite Colonel Mustard show, just because it was this experience, even more than just a story. It was a whole experience. And then after that, we did we brought back Jurassic Park the musical again, and did it bigger and better.
It was in 3D, wasn't it? Turned out.
we actually completely rewrote the script and score from top to bottom, which might not have been a great idea for our sanity, but was a lot of fun. It ended up being a totally different show than the first one,
and. That also was somewhat innovative in that, like, the staging is that we had the audience in the middle and then the show happened around them in 360 degrees. So basically the audience gets to go through these walls and through the Jurassic Park gates and sit in the middle and experience the show all around them. So they're sort of in it. And that was how we explained why it was 3D.
Yeah. It sounds great. It sounds really good. In terms of then what's next then for the Colonel Mustard Group, and what, obviously you mentioned the Brothers Karamazov that you did,
right?
What's the next big plan for it? Is there a new show on the horizon or new shows?
Yes, we are currently working on writing Phil, are we talking about what it is or is it a secret? I'm not sure.
Okay, saying what it is.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead and
Is this an exclusive?
It?
Am I getting an exclusive here?
You actually are.
This is exciting. Okay.
Yeah. The show we're working on right now, at least the working title, is Robin Hood and Her Merry Men and Women.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah.
It's a Robin Hood story, but it's set in the West.
Cool.
It's a Western, and we've got a female Robin Hood, it's a bit of, you know, it's kind of a spin on the Robin Hood tale. Some of the tropes that you probably experience with the with the legends, the robbing from the rich, giving to the poor, the, you know, the kind of importance of land and of fighting, you know, corrupt leaders. But it also, you know, I think takes a lot of Robin Hood things and turns them on their head and inverts them, which we're pretty excited about. So yeah, Lindsay, anything else that I'm missing on it?
No, that's it. Yeah. So we're currently writing it, and it's going to sort of take place in the same universe that we created for Gods of the Prairie. So something that we're kind of interested in is like building out this world that we created back then and telling more stories that sort of live in it. Like, it's a little bit of a magical Old West that borrows a little bit from history and a little bit from mythology. And yeah, so we're excited to see how it goes. It's going to be epic and adventurous, and it should be funny, but I think it will also be maybe a little more dramatic than some of our past work.
It sounds like a really cool blend of mythology and yeah, different styles and everything. Brilliant. That sounds great. And I'm quite honored to have it as an exclusive on the XCast. There we go. Okay, well, that's great, guys. That was really interesting stuff about your company, about the X-Files, and about everything else you've done. So, yeah, it's been really, really nice to find out more. Moving on, I'm going to ask you then, a couple of different things before we finish. Part of the show is that every time we get guests on, we ask them, do you believe in? And normally when we're covering episodes, we tend to do whatever the paranormality is of the specific episode. But I'm just going to ask you both simply, do you believe in the paranormal?
I do. I think I do. I've heard enough stories of paranormal happenings. I mean, I suppose the paranormal... Well, wow, Tony, you've really gotten us into quite the jam here with this question.
It's a big question, in fairness.
Yeah, the paranormal really, it's quite broad, isn't it?
It is.
I would say yes, I certainly believe in like a spiritual dimension, and I believe in God, I believe in... I would consider myself very open-minded when it comes to some of these things. I'm also just very afraid of the paranormal, so I think that my fear of watching the X-Files definitely probably comes from my fear, my belief in the paranormal.
How about you, Phil?
I would say that I do believe in the paranormal. I think a lot of similar things to Lindsay, probably. I definitely believe in a spiritual world and all of that. And I don't know for sure about extraterrestrials, at least in the way that they have them on the X-Files, although I don't know if that totally counts as paranormal anyway. But yeah, I would say that I'm a fairly open-minded person about that.
I think it's a difficult question to answer for anyone who hasn't necessarily, you know, experienced directly something paranormal. It's a very broad question. Normally it's a bit more enclosed as to what paranormality it is.
I will say this, in reference to the Colonel Mustard and Mr. Albert Watkins, we always believed that Albert Watkins died at the Colonel Mustard house.
But
so we would talk about that, and we of course always reference him, but we never experienced any paranormal activity at the Colonel Mustard house. So I will say it was a house that seemed like it should be haunted, but for whatever reason, it was not. And these things are sometimes surprising.
If ever there was a house that should have been haunted by someone, it was that one.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So not sure what was going on there.
You sound disappointed, Lindsay, that you're actually disappointed.
I am. No, I am. One time we thought that we found a secret passage in the house, and that was very scary and exciting. But then we realized it was just like some loose wooden panels. So, yeah, nothing too crazy going on there. There's enough craziness with all of our musicals. So perhaps there's not room for anything else.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, I hope that maybe one day, you know, the paranormality of the Mustard House will be proven, and Albert might show his face. You never know. But yeah, thanks for that. Finally, then, it's time for the X quiz. And normally, this would be based on the specific episode we're covering. But this time, because it's this special episode about the X-Files musical, the quiz is going to be on the X-Files musical. So I'm going to test you both on your knowledge of the show that you haven't, like, probably watched or thought about much for 5 years. So good luck. You have five questions that I've plucked out from watching the show. Are you both ready?
Are we competing against each other?
If you want. Or is it... if you want, yeah, you can shout out the answer first.
Everything is a competition, Lindsay.
I know. I want to be on Phil's team.
Okay.
Okay, I'm ready.
Great. Okay, let's go. Question one. As well as the classic I Want to Believe poster, what film poster adorns the X-Files office?
Oh, God. I think I might know.
Okay.
Is it the... Oh, I forget the name of the movie, but it's an old movie about, like, a woman, like, the 50-foot woman or something, or the attack of the 50-foot woman. Am I crazy?
It's not, that's not what I'm thinking of, but it might be on there, but you might be able to answer that, Phil.
Is it, I don't think it is, but is it Independence Day?
No, that would have been good if it was, though, because of the movie, where Mulder takes a piss on the Independence Day photo, poster. It's actually Twilight.
And, oh, yeah. I remember this now.
And there's a picture of Edward Cullen. which I assumed is a hint that Scully's a bit of a Edward Cullen fangirl. I don't know
I think that we were really excited when it arrived, and then we opened it and remembered that it was just a Twilight poster.
That's just a tribute to our brilliant set designers and production designers there, because wow, I don't remember that at all.
I'm worried now that none of these questions you guys are gonna get.
Sure, we're gonna get it.
Yeah, we'll get one.
Okay, all right then. Question two: name one of the two shows that Chaddy Chad named himself as guest host of on his resume.
Oh no!
And bonus points if you can get both.
As the ex-host?
As the guest, God. The guest host. He was guest host on two shows.
Oh. The Price is Right?
You are close. You are close, no. Lindsay.
Family Feud?
No. Phil?
Well, I mean, I'm only guessing based on the fact that Aaron and I wrote part of this. Was one of them like The Fifth Wheel or something? Because we used to watch the crap out of that show.
Is the fifth wheel the same as Wheel of Fortune?
Oh, no.
Oh, no!
Okay, because you were close.
The Fifth Wheel is a terrible dating show.
Okay. Because, you know, we had Wheel of Fortune in the UK, and we had The Price is Right, and I think Family Feud is known as Family Fortunes in the UK. So I know those shows. But it was Wheel of Fortune and Temptation Island.
Oh, I do remember Temptation Island now.
Yeah. Honestly, that's a great joke, and I'm glad that someone wrote it back then.
It's very funny.
But I, yeah, wow.
Very funny. Okay, question three. What is the mysterious man called who visits Scully in a vision and gives her advice? Now, there are kind of two names, I think, for him. You can call him.
I know this one.
Go on, then.
Shall we say it together?
Sure.
Thomas the
Humanimangelian.
Yes! The Doubting Thomas, as she called him. The human. I do love the word. Humanimangelian.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Humanimangelian.
I remember on that show, at some point while we were writing it, we got really committed to lumping as many words together as we could. Like, it was like a challenge to see what things you could connect to humanimal.
Yeah. I think that was a really good word. And credit to, is it Laura who you mentioned who played Scully? Credit yes. to her, because she said that a lot. She had to say that a yeah. lot, and she never fluffed that word. So yeah, tell her well done from me.
Well done.
Human, part angel, part animal, and part alien.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, question four. Well done for that one. Question four. This might be a bit tricky. What does Dr. Thoreau's creature, Pedro, have?
Oh.
I'll give you a clue. God. It's an illness.
Oh, no. Hemophilia?
No. Phil, do you want to have a guess?
I don't remember at all.
Okay, at one point, right towards the end, he says that Pedro's got salmonella, and Pedro just
sort of... It's like his last thing that he says.
Yeah, yeah. And Pedro just holds his stomach and looks in pain.
That is right, because I think, was Pedro a snail or something? There's like some animal. Yeah, he's a snail, so I think that you can get salmonella from a snail. Am I just making that up? I don't know where that came from.
I don't know. But, Aaron wrote that line.
I think we ought to get that, like, you know, out there as a possible medical fact. You can get salmonella from a snail.
That sounds so stupid as I say it out loud, but I think in my heart of hearts, I believe that you can get salmonella from a snail.
We need to get people believing that, if it's true or not. Okay, finally then, question 5. You will get this one, because it was mentioned earlier. What book is Thomas reading when he visits Scully at the end?
Right, The Da Vinci Code, of course.
Yeah, there you go. And it makes me laugh, because he comes in, doesn't he, and he says, should we go for coffee? Look, I'm reading this book. Do you want, we go? And she says, if I say maybe, will you leave?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah. I think it's funny because Thomas certainly represents like a certain breed of like quasi-intellectual person that we would meet frequently at college. And he, like, I think because we were in college at the time or had just recently graduated from college, that's why we created that character Thomas. Like the guy who just wants to talk about ideas and like talk about this stuff, but never really like do anything in his life. And I think also maybe the Da Vinci Code had come out more recently at that time. So it was more of like a hot topic for people to be talking about at college.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's just a funny book, though. Now, whenever someone brings out the Da Vinci, it just makes you laugh.
it's a great reference.
Yeah.
This has been really fun to walk down memory lane. I feel like I need to rewatch the musical.
Well, I think you should. It's and out of 5, you've both scored 2. That's not too bad, considering it's been like 5 years.
Feels pretty bad.
Cool, that's about it then, really. I just want to thank you both for your time and for talking about X-Files the Musical. It's been really fun, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
No, it's been great. So let's where can we find you guys and Colonel Mustard online? Is there a website? Is there a Twitter? Where can people find out more?
Yeah. Let's see. You can check out more Colonel Mustard stuff at www.thecolonelmustard.com. Make sure you get that "the" in there. And we are on Twitter sometimes, and we also have a pretty active Facebook group. So if you just search for Colonel Mustard Theater on Facebook, you'll find us. There is an X-Files the Musical group. I believe it is closed, but if you request to join it, we will grant your request. And you can check out our videos. We also have a YouTube channel, which I believe is Colonel Mustard Theater. And yeah, we hope that maybe we can revisit some X-Files material again someday. But oh, I should also mention that we have a Bandcamp channel where you can listen to the X-Files soundtrack.
Oh, awesome.
So maybe I can send you that link and you can post it with the podcast or something like that.
Please
but
do.
If you just Google Bandcamp and X-Files the Musical, it's sure to come up.
Great. That would be really fun to listen to them independently. So yeah, that'd be really, really good. Thank you. Do check out Colonel Mustard, guys, especially for American listeners, because I know we do have a few. So if you're around Nebraska and these shows are on, go and see them. Definitely check out the website and the Twitter and Facebook and everything like that. I'm envious that you guys are lucky enough in the US to potentially go and see these shows. It'd be difficult for me to get a flight and do that.
Hey, you can come visit us someday.
Well, thank you.
Just a direct flight to Lincoln, Nebraska.
So yeah, do check these guys out. It's been really fun to talk to you both. You can find us on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook at the XCast. We're on iTunes. If you just subscribe there, just type in the XCast, do subscribe, do leave us a 5-star review if possible, or just a review would be nice, just to get more people knowing about our show. And we'll be going back into more of the episodes in season one and any nominations for future seasons we've got as we go through the show. So once again, big thanks, guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. So fun.
Awesome. And yeah, we'll see you next time, guys. And remember, trust no one.
Conspiracy is our lonely mission. Do you want to know how brains work, how to screw with people's heads? It's all a conspiracy.
Oh, baby.
Governments use mind control. Water's laced with Demerol. They may have your cysts already. Alien brainwashing would be quite strong. She might believe she's been a goose all along. But it's harder to explain her physical condition.
Extraterrestrial,
technological,
biomechanical,
antibacterial.
Hey, Mulder, can I see a picture of her?
Yep.
Okay, Mulder, what the?
Duck man.
Kitty man.
Platypus
man.
Have you ever seen a man who has a tail or web in hands and wondered how it came to be?
How it came to be.
Monster, weirdo, sideshow freak. More sinister than you think. It's all a conspiracy. First you take some modern science. DNA, Rhombolus, Rhombolus. DNA, Rhombolus. DNA recombinatorics. Then you find a very twisted dude. Give him funding, build a lab. He'll do research on your tab. And he'll make humanimals for you.
We know the Nazis tried it.
Yeah, we know Hitler will do something like that, yeah.
Russians tried it.
Those sneaky Soviets.
We think Saddam tried it.
Okay. We can't make a joke on this one yet, I guess.
But me, I have my doubts.
Now there's a crazy doctor. He lives in Massachusetts and he's mixing people with animals. Yes, he's making humanity more.